Welcome to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing,
Phil? Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And it's Labor Day. And that is the officially designated day that you may remember that without labor, nothing in the whole country or around the world moves. And nice of them to allow that. There is, of course, an International Workers' Day. It's called May Day, but those who loyal to Her Majesty and to Washington or whatever think that it's probably not a good idea that we go around having unapproved May Day. So they gave us a Labor Day. Labor Day is the one where you have to say, may I? I mean, pardon me, may, yes, that's right. If you say, may I, then they say, yes, that's okay, you can have that. And provided they fly their warplanes up and down over you to remind you that they can take care of everything. Today we're going to be talking to a really outstanding Canadian journalist, Eve Engler, about an article he published in Counterpunch magazine over the weekend, the internet magazine founded and directed by the wonderful Alexander Coburn, who is unfortunately no longer with us, but it's a great site, and it you always want to go there to know what is actually going on in the world. And I was very glad to see that they had published this piece. It's about Canada's involvement with provocative behavior towards the Islamic Republic of Iran at a time when the consequences might be a little more serious than they tell the Canadian people. So we'll be doing that. And then later in the program, we're going to talk with Zafar Bangash. Zafar is the editor of crescent-online.net, and he's also quite a prominent spokesperson on issues to do with the Middle East, particularly the neocolonial policies of great powers in that region. And Zafar is very familiar with everything there that we need to know. And so we're going to be checking with Zafar on that, probably be about the halfway point. And it's very important that we note to remind there is an important conference coming up. It's called Breaking the Silence, Justice for the Cuban Five. It's a People's Tribunal and Assembly, and it's going to be held in Toronto on September 21 through 23. And just to remind our listeners, it's Breaking the Silence, Justice for the Cuban Five, People's Tribunal and Assembly. It will be held on those dates. And as you know, the Cuban Five, Rene Gonzalez, Gerardo Hernandez, Antonio Guerrero, Ramon Labanino and Fernando Gonzalez were arrested 14 years ago and wrongly convicted in a Miami courtroom of conspiring to commit espionage against the U.S. on behalf of the Cuban government. They have been imprisoned ever since, despite growing international demands to overturn this miscarriage of justice and to win their immediate release. The People's Tribunal and Assembly is being planned by trade union and solidarity organizations from across Canada in coordination with the Canadian Network on Cuba and organizations in Quebec, and will feature a number of prominent Canadian and international panelists, including actor Danny Glover, filmmaker Saul Landau, Unite the Union UK leader Tony Woodley, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan, relatives of the Cuban Five, and numerous lawyers and experts on the Cuban-American relations and impact witnesses. Last week on this show, we were speaking to Keith Bolander about this. Keith Bolander has written one of the best accounts of the impact of terror carried out against the Cuban state, directed out of such places as Miami, where people walk free who committed these crimes. There is a website, freethefivepeoplestribunal.org, and five is the number five, freethefivepeoplestribunal.org. And the goal is to educate and to break the silence of mainstream media about the case and to map out campaigns for justice for the Cuban Five. So everyone is really encouraged to get involved with this work. And I'll remind you again, the site is freethefivepeoplestribunal.org. And we will be returning to the subject on the Taylor Report, and I'm sure other programmers at CIU and elsewhere directed would like to be part of this, because that there is a alternative radio out of play. Because when those who have the most power and the most money, it turns out same people, decide that something doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. They simply block it out. And, for example, there was a non-aligned movement meeting, 120 states attending, two-thirds of the world's countries attended this non-aligned movement meeting in Tehran. And you wouldn't know that from the Toronto Star unless you read the editorial saying it was a bad thing. And grossly distorting what occurred there. But we get used to that. So that's why you have alternative radio. And again, I'm going to just tell you, freethefivepeoplestribunal.org. And that's the number five. And the assembly is going to be on September 21 through 23, April 2012. And Phil, I think you also have an announcement of something coming up at Betsatoon this week.
That's right. On Thursday evening, September the 6th, at Betsatoon, 612 Markham Street in Toronto, Cuba's International Health Brigades and the Latin American School of Medicine, a guest speaker, Dr. Gregory Wilkinson, hosted by Raul de the Cuban consul in Toronto, and Keith Ellis, a friend of the Taylor Report, a coordinator of the CNC Cuba for Haiti campaign. A first-hand account of Cuba's approach to medical training and recent work in cholera-stricken Haiti. That's 7 p.m. on Thursday, September the 6th at Betsatoon, 612 Markham Street. Admission is free.
Mm-hmm. As we often do in the show, we note historical dates. Today is September the 3rd. And it is, we're being told about the War of 1812, and so this going to September the 3rd, 1812, the forces under General Brock had moved deep into the United States and were waging war there. That's how you defend your country, the British territory. On this day at a place in Indiana near the Ohio River, Pigeon's Roost. A little village was attacked. 24 people were killed. Half of the 24 were children. They were all scalped. And according to historians, some of the scalps were sent to General Brock at Detroit so he would know that his allies were doing their work. Just to talk about the consequences of war and why people ought not to be lighthearted or careless of their historical facts. So, in other words, that would be about the third massacre that had occurred after the initiation of the war. It led to also the massacres under Governor and / General Harrison. Then there were counterattacks against Native Americans, and villages were destroyed and burned. An important detail. And also, I have to warn you, 1812 is very important. We talk about it on the show. It's a British war with the Americans over the issue of whether or not America could be neutral. And it was also in support of, the larger effort against Napoleon. Incidentally, about this date, Napoleon himself, the French army, was outside Moscow. They were at Borodino. And that was, go and read Tolstoy, War and Peace. He describes the Battle of Borodino. And forget the rest of the book. Just read that part. Because it's a wonderful account of how generals initiate things, consequences of which they have no idea. And during the battle, they often don't know what is actually going on. So we can excuse the generals. But the people who write history books, I have one in front of me, really aren't too helpful when they don't even, after 200 years, can't get it right. There's a guy named Mark Zelke. He's won awards. This book is called For Honor's Sake, The War of 1812 and the Brokering of an Uneasy Peace. And he says that at this in Indiana Territory, all the U.S. Forts were overrun. And he names one that's rather important called Fort Wayne. And I don't know how he would do that, because Fort Wayne wasn't overrun. just one of those little details. But, you know, you're reading along. I mean, the reader is trusts himself into the hands of somebody who's got a really nice-looking book, you know, and there are footnotes and everything. And he said Fort Wayne was overrun. And he said all the American forts of the and this is kind of important, because people, they portray this War of 1812, particularly beginning that year, as brave British soldiers protecting Ontario. That's not where they were. The brave British soldiers at this point, this is September, are now deep into Indiana and Ohio. And they were attacking. They did attempt to take Fort Wayne, bless their hearts, and they were beaten. They did attack another fort called Fort Harrison, where the commanding officer was a man named Zachary Taylor. And Zachary ended up president of the United States largely because he wasn't defeated. He held on to the fort. Anyway, I want Mark to know that, and I want him to look it up, because he really ought not to tell his readers silly things. And it, you know, the picture boy for this stuff is Pierre Burton, who he wrote a very readable book, but much of it is kind of, it looked like it was a script maybe for Lorne Greene and his friends, and they wanted to have Jay Silverheels play Tecumseh. They really have a Hollywood Indian idea, which is not helpful to anybody. Now, speaking of Hollywood Indians, we have Clint Eastwood, who the last time I heard about him making a public idiot of himself was when he decided to give, why would a relative call me at this moment? Anyway, I wanted to give Marlon Brando a hard time. Marlon Brando took a stand. He refused to take, accept his, well, he would accept his Academy Award, but he had a young woman, Native American, accept the award and denounce Hollywood for its stereotyping of Native Americans, First Nations people, / Indians. And Clint Eastwood followed that by making jokes about her and about Brando, whose shoes he could not carry. And so now he's back, and the Republicans decided to put him up and give him a stage to say obscene things on a primetime television, to imagine himself as a comedian, which turns out he is not. And I think it's kind of an interesting cultural moment, you know, crossroads here, because we've always been advised by our ethical teachers, including school teachers and ministers and others, not to confuse theater people with real people. They say, no, don't get me, you know, confuse the guy playing Caesar with Caesar. You know, that's bad for the mind to do that, so don't do it. But they see, Clint is an actor. He seems to have forgotten the same instructions. An actor ought not to mistake himself for his character. And this is where we have the funny moment. He actually thinks he's Dirty Harry, or he thinks he's the guy who liberated Grenada, which wasn't liberated, it was bombed. I mean, he played a Marine officer in a movie where he pretended, and he's very good at pretending. He pretended he was a Marine officer, and he bravely led his men, etc. Now, of course, in the real moment of the bombing of Grenada, the main target, the first one hit where people were killed, was a mental asylum on the island, really primitive conditions, but that's what they hit. That didn't make it, as far as I know, to the film. But Eastwood actually has this problem, and he did it right in front of all of us. And it reminded me of a figure in history, theater. They say that Johnny Weissmuller, who played Tarzan, the most credible Tarzan, I think he's a consensus favorite, of everybody's favorite Tarzan, because he seems really dumb and not to know what's going on during the film. And so they believed that he could be sort of a man of nature or whatever. So in his last days of life, the actor, Johnny Weissmuller, was frightening the nurses in his wing of the hospital because he kept doing his hospital. So apparently, I'm sorry, and by the way, it might be apocryphal, but it's a good story. And so he thought he was actually Tarzan. And Clint Eastwood actually thinks he's, you know, Dirty Harry, or a clever guy. But he forgets you have to have a writer to be a clever guy. And so all of that is an issue. One other detail from the Republican convention I want to make sure I mention is that they're getting all the papers now want to scare us about Romney. Romney and the other guy are really scary, scary people. And I would really urge you, and I'm talking to people who attend theater, don't get confused. They are also pretty much actors. And we all lived through this. Lyndon Johnson ran for president of the United States, and his opponent was Barry Goldwater. And they said, if Goldwater's elected, he'll bomb Vietnam. He'll begin to bomb Vietnam. So you have to elect Lyndon Johnson. So Lyndon Johnson got elected and bombed Vietnam. So keep that in mind when they try to scare you. Remain calm. And remember, they're all actors. Anyway, I think we should take a quick break so that I can make sure we're all set to go. Do we have Eve Engler? Oh, I'm sorry.
When hey, Phil.
Hi, Eve. I'm sorry to be doing that to you. I had a note in front of me, or at least when I saw it, I thought I had a number I didn't recognize. I wanted to make sure it was actually the real Eve Engler. So it is a real Eve Engler. Hey, thanks for joining us. You wrote a great article, very timely, because Canada seems to have a kind of a double face. I mean, on the one hand, we have a guy who's really quite militant and loves weapons, and he likes to be seen with the troops. But then on the international stage, we're always hearing about Obama and the French and all that. Now, you focused right on this dangerous area of the Persian Gulf and Canada's involvement. So let me just ask this kind of a flat question. Is it true there are Canadian warships in the Persian Gulf, and why are they there? What's going on?
It is true to, at least if the Ottawa citizen and other corporate to be believed. There are a couple Canadian naval vessels, one that departed in June, one that departed in January for a year to patrol the area. And according to one National Post article, it's intimately tied into the Harper government's hostility towards Iran. And they're part of a larger U.S. Naval presence in the area. And that's, I think, just a, you know, there's reports going back a few years of very aggressive Canadian naval procedures or practices or kind of operations right off the coast of Iran. And sort of stoking tension in the area, and I think it's all part of a possibility of a full scale war against Iran. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that right now there already is a low level war against Iran. It's just a question of will that be expanded to a full scale bombing campaign in the coming months or years.
Mm-hmm. This is Eve Engler, and the article is published in the Weekend Counterpunch, asking the question, is Canada already making war on Iran? And Eve, where is our debate? You point out it actually isn't a secret, although in a way it kind of seems to get under the attention of people, but I don't hear anybody saying, we should be careful in this region. Couldn't we have a Canadian policy? I mean, it seems like it's just the bully's sidekick, and with the idea that we'll never get in any trouble. Nobody from Canada will ever get hurt doing this. I don't hear anybody speaking up.
Yeah, no, there is it's a more general problem on foreign policy, where the NDP, there's a long history of the NDP or going back to the CCF, way back when the CCF criticized Iran's nationalization of its oil back in 1951.
It did.
That was one of the things I was most struck by going through the Ensert archives doing the Lester Pearson book. So there's a long history of the CCF-NDP basically going along with aggressive, militaristic Canadian foreign policy and being supportive of U.S. or British imperialism in the Middle East, and I think you're seeing the continuation of that. At best, the NDP will say that we should focus more on the sort of sanctions level and less on the militaristic level. But what we have going on is right now with vis-a-vis sanctions, and part of the starting off point for that piece on Iran is that. There was a report in the community newspaper in Vancouver, in North Vancouver, is the Iranian community, that there's been very little money going that's been raised for earthquake victims. A couple weeks ago, there was a pretty bad earthquake in Iran.
300 people killed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Over 300 people killed, and there's very little money going, and there's, according to the articles, in large part because the Iranian community in Vancouver is nervous about whether sanctions block sending relief funds to Iran, and they have good reason to be nervous. I'm sure people may have seen that 6 weeks ago or so, Toronto Dominion started canceling the bank accounts of a whole number of Iranian Canadians who had sent money or received money from Iran. And we're talking about people who have pensions from Iran, right? You know, people who are getting, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month pensions from Iran, and they're starting to get their bank accounts closed down because the Toronto Dominion is saying they're trying to uphold the Canadian government's, the conservative government's, you know, sanctions program against Iran. So, I mean, you're basically, the Canadian government is full throttle in a process of trying to destroy the Iranian economy, and these are just two sort of things, that recent examples of how severe the sanctions campaign is. And so it's a question of, I think, from an NDP perspective, they tend to focus more on the sort of the softer side of the imperialism, be that the sanctions.
Yeah, they like sanctions, right?
Or condemnation of human rights. That's the sort of focus they put on. Whereas the conservatives, they're happy with all of it. We'll even do that, but we'll also do the military kind of side. And
yes, it's interesting. I started with that point, but that's rather striking. I mean, that this business of sort of showing their teeth, being proud of how they're you quote McKay, for example, saying, "Well, we're always getting ready. We're always preparing for war." Again, you say, well, we have the soft side guys who say, well, we'd rather have sanctions. But you would think they would say, well, we don't want to see that. We, an actual engagement, which could happen at any moment in that region.
For sure. I mean, these aren't when Peter McKay tells Sun News that the Defense Department is always preparing and planning for war against Iran. That when his quotes were vis-a-vis Iran specifically, not just general preparing for, anything in the world. That's happening at the same time when there are Canadian troops occupying a country bordering Iran. There are Canadian troops very close to the border with Iran and Afghanistan. There are Canadian naval vessels, patrolling off the coast. There's going back a number of years, there's lots of accusations of Canadian spying at the embassy in Tehran. This is not sort of idle planning that's, just divorced from actual, military. So from the Iranian perspective, they would be, right to be extremely nervous. You got Canada saying that. You obviously have Israel saying, even much more extreme things. You got the U.S. with bases, circling Iran and dozens and dozens of bases and military vessels circling Iran. This is serious stuff. And there's no, as far as I know, there's nobody in the mainstream of Canadian political life that is coming out and saying, outright condemning any possibility of Canada being involved in a military campaign against Iran. Instead, you have, the head of the military back in July coming out and saying the troops want another war. And total silence, it's whether it comes to pass.
That's where we go for our political leadership. A private with a rifle somewhere.
That's certainly what Harper would like.
Some of whom have found it enthusiastically endorse right wing causes with tattoos and everything else.
Yeah,
and the real heroes. Pardon me. Now, you mentioned also that we have another thing that's going on that's double standard. They apparently, people can go from here or people can send money from here and organize monies that would go to support armed movements such as those taking place in Syria. And the government looks the other way. But if you're a Palestinian and you're worried about people in the West Bank and you want to help with a hospital, you're liable to be arrested.
Oh yeah, I mean that's people might be, some listeners might be aware of what's happened to the Mississauga-based charity IRFAN, International Relief Fund for the Afflicted and Needy, I believe is the the acronym name, and basically they were they've been raising. They got about a couple thousand of the High Point orphans in Gaza that they were sponsoring, and they tried to send a dialysis machine to a hospital in Gaza. Obviously, now since 2006, 2007, Hamas has been in charge of Gaza, so the hospital effectively is under, you know, the under the Hamas government, and they've had their charitable status eliminated for supposed ties to Hamas because these orphans, again, supporting orphans in Gaza and this dialysis machine. On the other hand, you have the Harper government saying openly, you can help settler organizations in the West Bank that are, you know, further encroaching on Palestinian land that are, you know, completely illegal according to international law, even according to official Canadian government policies, even, you know, illegal according to Canadian government policy. They still, in theory at least, could consider, you know, the West Bank illegally occupied. You can support, and if you pick up the Canadian Jewish News, you'll see lots of ads for different Canadian charities that support the IDF, the Israeli military, in different ways. So you can receive a tax a write-off. The government will subsidize giving money to the settler organizations or Israeli military. But if you happen to want to help some orphans in Gaza, it's actually it technically can even be seen as illegal to have support an organization that has any ties to Hamas, which is identified as a terrorist organization in Canada. And then vis-a-vis Syria, people must have saw how the government wanted to give a couple million bucks, $2 million to a Syrian charity that was seemed very tied in with some of the jihadist kind of groups, which they ended up backing off on.
They sort of wanted it both ways, right? They wanted to be seen to be trying to help that guy, but then when they got caught, they said, well, I guess we shouldn't do that. But they were already way down the road. One wonders, maybe that's almost a public relations exercise.
And just in terms of a more general kind of, double standards, you look at how much attention there has been over what's going on in Syria, and clearly incredible levels of human rights abuses that the government, the Assad government's responsible for. So clearly lots to be condemned. It's obviously a much more complicated story than is being portrayed in most of our media. But, Canada, according to the Ottawa Citizen of about 2 or 3 weeks ago, had 9 different rounds of sanctions already against Syria. There's been at least one more round of sanctions. There's been at least 10 different rounds of Canadian sanctions vis-a-vis Syria over the past year or so. Well, in the east of the Congo, over the past 4 or 5 months, according to UN numbers, something in the range of 500,000 people have been displaced because a Rwandan-backed military reinvasion that's displaced something like 500,000 people. Huge number of massacres. Basically no comment from Canadian officials, criticizing. Basically no discussion of it in the dominant media in this country, even though, this is not, UN has established very clearly, you're talking about over 500,000 people. In Syria, I think it's in the range of a million and a bit that have been displaced. So, not quite as severe in the east of the Congo, but comparable kind of numbers, yet absolutely no discussion of that matter. And that speaks to, our relationship vis-a-vis Rwanda, and, how Syria is seen as an enemy, Rwanda seen more as an ally.
Yeah, it's nice to be reminded that politics is what is key and the interests of the great powers. This is Eve Engler. He's written a great piece. It's published in Counterpunch on the weekend. And Eve, about Canada's involvement with and threat to, actually, the Islamic Republic. Lastly, you made a point in your article about the issue of nuclear weapons, which the U.S., of course, is making the thin red line or whatever they call it, and always very threatening, both Israel and the U.S. But you point out that there have been various resolutions coming from U.N. sanctioned bodies on trying to limit nuclear weapons and raising the issue of involving Israel in the discussion of who possesses them and how they might be reduced, and Canada is against that.
And a number of occasions have tried to block some of the Arab-sponsored calls for a nuclear-free Middle East. There's actually one coming up in the next couple of days. Conference might have already been taking place right now. I saw a few media reports that talked about Western countries trying to block the discussion of Israel's weapons. I didn't find a confirmation that Canada was involved in that, but almost certainly it was, because there's been a number of previous news reports from Bloomberg and other media outlets that have discussed how Canada has been one of the three countries that are pushing, that's stopping the discussion of Israel nuclear weapons. That, to get to the level of the double standards, is really off the chart.
And how could peace ever be reached if one party who has a weapon arguing with another party that doesn't? I mean, obviously the issue of weapons has to be kind of taken off the table if the two are going to resolve their problem, right? I mean, Canada, that's a war policy to not say to them, hey, now look, we want both of you to put your weapons down.
It should be any sensible kind of negotiation would include that. And when you look at the power imbalance on all this, the U.S. spends something like $60 billion a year on nuclear weapons, which is about four times Iran's entire military budget, right? The U.S. has something like 5,000 warheads. Israel has somewhere between, we don't know exactly, but 100 to 300. Iran has none. The double standards and the power imbalance here are just, off the chart by anybody looking at this from a sort of somewhat objective kind of standpoint. Yeah. But you basically hear none of that in the corporate media. I haven't done any serious analysis, but I bet you if you did an investigation of the last 10 years of the Globe and Mail and Toronto Star and others, you'd find four mentions of Israel's nuclear weapons, and you'd find 1,000 mentions of Iran's non-existent nuclear weapons.
And how we better do something about it?
Exactly. So, the climate is just—it's so skewed from reality. It's even hard to start, interacting with it. Yeah. But the double standards are really, really severe.
Yeah. Well, from my book, we had to start with your article in Counterpunch. Eve Engler, we really appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me, sir.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Eve Engler, and he's written a number of great books. I really enjoyed that comment about he found out that the NDP was against Iran having its own oil. This is the Taylor Report. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, and you can check us out, Taylor-Report.com. We're going to take a break. We'll be back and talk to Zafar Bangash. Well, I told you we'd be back, and we are. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm going to remind you again, we're having this People's Tribunal, Justice for the Cuban Five, Break the Silence. It's going to be in Toronto September 21 through the 23rd, 2012. Men who've now been in prison for 14 years because they were trying to protect their country from terrorist attack. That's the way the ball bounces. Fortunately, there are many people in the world know about them and are speaking up. And one of the most prominent, one of the great actors, Danny Glover, is going to... he's using his reputation in a creative and powerful way. And by the way, he knows wherever he speaks. It's very interesting to contrast him with that moron... Eastwood. Hey, by the way, if there's any Eastwood and people who want to separate him and his films, that cannot be done. If you think he was a great actor or a great whatever, take another look. All those films are full of hatred, particularly race hatred, and advocacy of violence is the solution to every single problem. He's somewhat mental, and now you all can see that, but he always was. There's nothing new happening here. So it's important to know that. In a moment, we will be talking to Zafar Bangash. We're going to talk about this conference of the non-aligned movement. Incidentally, they've chosen Islamic Republic to be the host and chair of the non-aligned movement for 3 years. So, and that's 120 states, if I count them right. that might turn out to be that they do represent a majority, well, close to a majority of humankind, but certainly a majority of the states of the earth. And I think we are joined now by Zafar Benghash himself. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes, hello, Phil. I am here. I'm sorry, it's a little noisy here. I'm going to get out of this noisy place.
Okay.
I was supposed to be at home, but I'm not at home.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, we don't mind a little local color. That's okay. It lends to your credibility. This is Zafar Benghash, and he writes always about matters to do and has authoritatively about the Middle East. And questions of Islam in the world. And Zafar, I was just saying that this non-aligned conference movement, it just was held in Tehran. I think it kind of came on people like a tsunami. People didn't realize this was going to happen, that Iran was going to assume the leadership of the non-aligned movement for 3 years. Am I right?
Yes. Actually, the manner in which the non-aligned movement summit took place, it actually stunned a lot of people because, people are not expecting that there will be such a large attendance or that it would attract so much attention worldwide. And in fact, the attempts that were made by the U.S. and Israel to try to dissuade various leaders from attending, those attempts failed completely, and in fact, it added to the success and aura of the conference itself, and it was held over a period of 6 days, and there were more than 700 delegates and representatives from all over the world. Now, just for the benefit of your listeners, the Non-Aligned Movement is a movement of 120 countries, mm-hmm. and there are an additional 21 countries or organizations that have observer status over there. So, for instance, China has observer status there. Russia was invited to the conference, and there was a very senior Russian representative present there. In this conference, there were at least 53 heads of state or heads of government. That means either
53.
Presidents or 53, yes. So either presidents or prime ministers were present personally, and the other 70 or so countries were represented either by their vice presidents, by their foreign ministers, or other senior officials. So in that sense, it was an incredibly successful conference.
This is a country under siege from
exactly.
Western powers, sanctions
exactly.
and military threats and all these things.
Absolutely.
And the Prime Minister of India came?
Absolutely. The Prime Minister of India was there. The President of Egypt was there. The Emir of Qatar was there. The Prime Minister of Syria was there. The Prime Minister of Iraq was there. The President of Pakistan was there. You name it, they were all there. They were all there, and they all defied the U.S. threats. And they said, no, we are going to go there, and we are going to participate in this conference and this summit, there were in fact a number of very important resolutions also passed, or the summit declaration as it was called.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was that Iran has the full right to develop its nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. The summit also declared that countries should not be issuing threats against other countries. The declaration also said that the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran are illegal and they should be lifted, and that there should be no threats of war against Iran. So all kinds of...
Those are results of agreement.
There.
I mean, that's just not just an executive saying something.
There was absolutely. So you see that, for years, the U.S. and its allies have been trying to isolate Iran, whereas in fact we found that it was the U.S. that was completely isolated as far as this summit was concerned.
By the way, in terms of potential for world peace, this is a very positive development because the U.S. has been advertising the idea that it can do as it pleases, And it likes to use the word. They invoke that word, the expression world community. They like to say, well, the world community will have to decide. Well, it looks like the world community has decided.
Exactly. The world community was there. And they did decide. And they, in fact, you see, if we look at the non-aligned movement objectives and principles, they essentially talk about peaceful coexistence, non-interference in each other's internal affairs, and that mutual cooperation, respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of each country, and to resolve their differences through dialogue. So when you look at these objectives that they have laid out, and these objectives weren't laid out last week, they've been laid out as far back as 1961, yes. Or in fact even earlier than that, 1955. These were the five founding principles of the non-aligned movement.
The old Bandung Conference.
Bandung Conference, exactly. Mm-hmm. And these have been, of course, over the years, they went into a little bit of into the background because the non-aligned movement lost some of its luster, mm-hmm. primarily because, if you keep in mind that, for instance, the last chairman of the non-aligned summit movement was Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. And so obviously you wouldn't expect much from Hosni Mubarak, who's currently cooling his heels in a jail hospital, etc.
Well, he was known for taking naps, I think, for most of
exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so, he was basically pursuing an American agenda, so the non-aligned movement lost some of its luster. Mm-hmm. But now that Iran has taken over the leadership for the next 3 years, and Iran, those who care to pay attention, has a policy which is very, very clear, which says neither east nor west. So, in fact, Iran is the only country in the world that is truly non-aligned. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, its policy embodies the principles of the non-aligned movement very, very clearly. So I believe that definitely also played a role, and the fact that much of the world does not accept the kinds of aggressive tactics that the U.S. and Israel and American allies
Exclusivism and intimidation.
Yes,
this exactly. Seems to be the order of the day.
Yeah, and along these lines, I think those people that pay attention Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who's a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, he had an article in the Sunday Observer yesterday in which he actually called for putting on trial George Bush and Tony Blair as war criminals. this was he said that these two people were primarily responsible for launching a war against Iraq on a pack of lies.
Yes.
And so here are other so-called leaders that threaten wars, whereas at the non-aligned summit, 120 countries or their representatives, they said that disputes should not be resolved through threats of war or wars, but that there should be a dialogue, that there should be discussions and negotiations, and this attitude of issuing threats, etc., is a relic of the past, and we should put it behind us, and we should move on from there.
Mm-hmm.
And, the non-aligned summit actually also proved that it, rather than the UN, truly represents the opinion of the international community, because the UN, of course, is used as a doormat by the U.S., particularly the Security Council, where it has veto power as well as a number of other countries. And so the opinion of the rest of humanity is vetoed by the U.S. or its allies, and therefore making a mockery of international opinion. Mm-hmm. Or the opinion of the international community.
Mm-hmm. This is Zafar Benguys, crescent-online.net. Zafar, there was a lot of creativity. It looked to me like the leaders had come there, wanting to work and having ideas and knowing that this is the people to be talking to. And for example, the president of Egypt said he thought that they should form a contact group to solve the issue of the crisis with Syria. And he says that the contact group should be the Islamic Republic, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. I noticed that Iran says, we agree.
Yes. We'd be happy to do that, although we think you should include Iraq, which is a neighbor. But, I mean, that is really interesting. Here's an initiative comes from the new Egyptian leader, accepted by the leader of the Islamic Republic. And there are those other fellows that are not terribly fond of either one of them. I don't know but who likes who. But,
yes.
I mean, but Mercy is, if I've got his name right, he's putting forward a practical
yes.
idea. And, you know, yes. you could see that could – the only problem with it would be that Hillary Clinton won't like it and would try to sabotage.
That's correct. In fact, you know, it's interesting to note that President Morsi of Egypt, when he made this proposal, he actually pointedly kept the U.S. out of it. And what he indicated was that the issue in Syria basically is a matter between – the regional countries, and they can solve this issue rather than outside powers interfering in the affairs of Syria. So I think the fact, and the other part of this thing is, or two points that are very important, that President Morsi is making a clear case that he is no longer going to take orders from the U.S. with respect to Egypt's foreign or domestic policies. And number two, that he is keeping the Americans out of the region to say that this is a matter that has to be resolved by the people themselves. And he very categorically stated that mm-hmm. war is not the way to resolve the Syrian crisis, that it has to be done through a process of dialogue in which all of the various parties within Syria and Syria's neighbors, immediate neighbors, ought to be involved. So it was also a message, an indirect message sent out to the Saudis and the Qataris, telling them that they are interfering in the internal affairs of Syria, that they should stop that. Mm-hmm. It was also a message to Turkey. Incidentally, Turkey had initially declined to attend or send a representative to the Non-Aligned Movement Summit, but at the last minute they decided to do so because they felt that if they didn't, initially they had declined, but then they did.
No, thank you very much. You've answered my – I had this question written here because they were reporting here. I mean, it had been reported. They were not in attendance.
But no, they were.
If I understand it, the dynamic of the conference going on, somebody in the office said, we better go to that conference.
Exactly. I think the Turkish leadership realized that by saying that they were not going there, they had actually shot themselves in the foot. So then they decided to send somebody so that they don't shoot themselves with the other foot.
Yeah, don't shoot both feet.
So at least they saved themselves a little bit of face so that, you know, they were present over there. And in that
by the way, Syria was present, right?
Absolutely. Syria sent its foreign minister as well as its prime minister. Both of them were there. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Because
so you see that there were a lot of very, very dynamic issues being discussed over there. And a lot of, I must say that a lot of fruitful discussions took place. There was the first 2 days, of course, was the expert-level meeting. Then the second 2 days were the foreign minister's meeting. And then the third set of 2 days were the leaders' meeting. So leaders or presidents or prime ministers of various countries. And mm-hmm. in that sense, it was a sort of build-up to the third aspect of the conference. And, of course, that third day was very massively attended by, as I said, at least 53 heads of state or heads of governments and vice mm-hmm. presidents and kings and prime ministers and foreign ministers, etc.
Yeah, and you know, the among the things that Washington and London really hate are the optics, because it's quite interesting to go online and find the photograph of Ban Ki-moon sitting politely with his hands between his knees listening to the Ayatollah Khamenei.
That's correct. Yes, that was a very, very, very interesting photograph. I noticed it as well. And, you know, it seemed as if he was about to fall down prostrate on the floor and kiss his feet.
And I look at that picture and I read the Toronto Star and they said that the Khamenei spluttered. And I thought, no, the Toronto Star spluttered, but it doesn't.
Yes.
Nothing in that photograph indicates any spluttering. The spluttering seems to be at the editorial office of the Star.
Yes, exactly.
Because they have to explain to their readers, how can this be? I mean, you know, one of their problems with the public here is that the world's going their way. Everything's under control. We're going to disarm and beat up on the Syrians and disarm and beat up on the Iranians. And then a meeting is held, and these people that they've been demonized, like President Ahmadinejad.
Yes.
He's addressing a conference of 120 countries.
Yes.
That he's reading out the final resolutions. And everyone is, of course, treating each other with appropriate respect and listening to one of the views. That is
right.
Not the picture that the John Waynes and the Clint Eastwoods and the Obamas painted for us of the world.
That's correct, yes. In fact, you know, I listened to the interview of Prince Hassan of Jordan. Now, of course, Jordan itself is a U.S. colony, but, I mean, Prince Hassan, in his interview, he made some very interesting remarks. You know, he actually pointed out that the world has moved on from the era of bullying and, you know, dictating to other countries. He said that we are no longer living in a unipolar world, as America and its allies want to project. In fact, he said that we live now in a multipolar world, and that there are definitely countries that are realizing that they have to work together in order to solve some of the pressing problems that the world faces.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually categorically stated that this particular non-aligned summit had made a very important contribution towards making this world a more peaceful place and encouraging dialogue and preventing the degradation of the environment and other terrible things, the wars that are going on. So it is a very interesting interview that he gave, and he was very forthright, and I was pleasantly surprised to hear him talk like that.
Well, he may like to have a future.
That's right, yes.
We are exactly. Hearing, I don't know if you're hearing these reports, but, you know, they say that there have been a rather large demonstrations in his country that are not being reported, rather big ones,
exactly.
Having to do with the increase in fuel prices, which apparently is driving the population mad.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the Jordanian economy is in very bad shape. They earn very little. And, of course, there have been massive demonstrations in the past, but particularly now that have erupted because of these very high fuel costs, and people are absolutely fed up. And so I think the wave that is sweeping that entire region in terms of bringing in change, Jordan cannot remain immune from it. I don't think that Saudi Arabia would remain immune from it either. There are, as well as Bahrain, that is also in the end of massive uprisings about which we seldom hear anything, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of the people or the people over there are fed up of the ruling family in Bahrain and they want to get rid of them. But I personally believe that the most interesting developments are taking place in Saudi Arabia, where the king once again has gone on, according to official Saudi statements, on vacation and treatment. So he has
yes.
gone to Morocco, and perhaps from there he would go to the U.S., and his second in command, the crown prince, he's also in poor health, and there are other princes that are, you know, in bad health because they are very old mm-hmm. now. And I think we are definitely likely to see major changes in Saudi Arabia when in fact all of these uprisings that are taking place all over the region.
Yes.
That Saudi Arabia cannot remain immune from that.
Well, and it's been a major meddler. And a financing, a source of finances. If that is beginning to hit a rough road, maybe the new gang, a new group, might want to back away from some of this adventure because
exactly.
You know they could end up burning themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right that Saudi Arabia has been the major financier of the uprising in Syria by sending weapons and all kinds of other equipment to continue to fuel the unrest over there, and yet they have not succeeded. I mean, they have failed in their mission to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad, and people in Saudi Arabia themselves have realized that, you know, if these people are such good Democrats, how come we don't have any democracy in Saudi Arabia?
Yes.
So they're asking for their rights as well, and
yes.
This has, like, you know, it was initially confined to the eastern parts of Saudi Arabia, where the majority of the population is Shia, but now it has spread to other parts as well. And given the fact that there are at least 30,000 political prisoners in Saudi Arabia, obviously the unrest and the dissatisfaction is very deep. And there are many people in Saudi Arabia, highly qualified, educated, university professors, doctors, human rights activists, etc., who are fed up of the situation, and they want to have that situation in their country changed because they want to make sure that they also enjoy the rights that the Saudi regime claims it is so fond of exporting to Syria, which is to have the rights of the Syrian people respected.
Mm-hmm. This is Zafar Benghash. The publication is crescent-online.net. And Zafar, just lastly, you alluded, of course, to the situation in Syria. The non-aligned movement actually made some helpful words. It'd be interesting to see what flows from it. But I want to know, what is your assessment of the condition of the of that government and its ability to hold on? And I guess I should ask, are they going to? There seems to be a desire to spread the fight
at
Lebanon, but I haven't noticed that they got it ignited. But Syrian government, in my opinion, seems to be a lot stronger than anybody thought. So, what do you think the situation in the future looks like for Syria?
Absolutely, I agree with you that I think the Syrian government is still largely intact. The turmoil has gone on for more than a year and a half, and if it was going to be dislodged, and I didn't think it was going to be, but anyway, if it was going to be dislodged, it would have already been dislodged by now. The external players were hoping that there would be mass defections from the government, there will be mass defections from the military, as they had engineered in Libya, for instance. Mm-hmm. Those did not occur. In fact, the government is now, it now appears more determined than ever to deal with these mercenaries that have come from outside, particularly Al-Qaeda-type mercenaries that are now working hand-in-glove with the Americans.
And it turns out that, Prime Minister Harper likes Muslim extremists.
Absolutely.
He doesn't have a problem with them.
That's right. Here is a situation whereby the Americans and its allies told us that they went to war in Afghanistan because they wanted to fight Al-Qaeda over there. Now they are financing Al-Qaeda in Syria. So please tell us which side are you on. Are you with them or against them, or what is the situation?
Yes.
But with respect to your question, I don't think that the Syrian government is in danger of falling.
Mm-hmm.
It won't. It is fully in control. And as you said, yes, the attempts are being made to spread this conflict to Lebanon, but it hasn't fully caught on. But I think the people that are trying to, or that are fueling this conflict there, even they realize that if it spread to Lebanon, it won't remain confined there. It would spread to other parts. It could engulf Turkey and Iraq and other countries. So it will be a complete mess that nobody would be able to control. So I think they are beginning to see that perhaps they might want to work out or find another solution to the problem rather than constantly harping and insisting on overthrowing the government over there.
Very good. Well, we will turn to the non-aligned movement and solve this.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Exactly. Thank you. Thank you very much. Zafar Benghash.
A great pleasure.
Okay.
Take care, sir. Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out at taylor-report.com. Carol, thank you very much. Phil Conlon, thank you, and we will see you next week.